Federal Affairs to order, Saturday, July 30th. What are we doing here Saturday? 2005? To accommodate Representative Dalto, we're going to take Senate Bill 818 first. We'll open a public hearing and work session. Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was hoping to ease into the morning here and sort of complete my wake-up procedure, but I guess we're going to go for Dalto. State Representative Billy Dalto is serving Oregon's 21st House District here in Salem. I want to thank you for accommodating our request for a work session and public hearing on Senate Bill 818 and various amendments. I am advancing two amendments this morning, B-12s and the B-13s. I'll talk about the B-12s first. The B-12s contain the language of Senate Bill 598, which Senator Allen Bates introduced earlier this session. We had held them back. I had held them back with the intention of trying to use them as a vehicle to try to expand some prescription drug programs that we were considering, but we weren't able to reach an agreement on that. So my Health and Human Services Committee shut down before we could move Senate Bill 598. Senate Bill 598 allows the Office of Oregon Health Policy Research to work with the manufacturers, the prescription drug manufacturers, to strengthen their pharmaceutical patient assistance programs to make sure that everybody who's entitled to highly reduced and free prescriptions under the manufacturers' programs are getting eligible. I like Senate Bill 598 and these B-12 amendments because what it does is it really facilitates Oregonians accessing those programs, and it uses this OOPR office, Oregon Health Policy Research Office, to do so. So they're good amendments, and I hope you'll pass them this morning. And Senator Bates may wish to speak to the B-12s.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The B-12s are amendments to this bill, which I've spoken to so many times now that I'm getting tired of hearing myself talk about it, but I'm going to give you one more shot at it, okay? We have programs in the state which are administered by individual parties, and what they do is they walk people through the way that you can get free drugs for indigent patients from the pharmaceutical companies, and it works extremely well. The paperwork's difficult to do at times, but these brokers do a great job of doing it, usually charging about $5 for a 90-day prescription, which the patient then gets for free. I've been using them heavily for the last 2 years. And have hundreds of patients on these programs. They do a great job, and the pharmaceutical industry is very supportive of them. The trick is getting all the paperwork done, getting it done in a reasonably quick fashion, so the patients get the medications they need. That's what the Dash-12s are really all about, is getting that going on more of a statewide program instead of these little enclaves and sort of a cottage-type industry we have, and Uber is going to help us wire that program up. There's a couple other things, though, that are now involved with this that I think we need to comment to also that you may not be aware of. One is we have a bulk purchasing bill in the House. Opening that bulk purchasing bill up to all indigent patients, regardless of age, would make this a more effective program. I'm concerned that the bulk purchasing not be opened up to private, but to only people who are indigent, below the 185% of the poverty level, and that there not be an age restriction on that, because many of these people are in the 30s and 40s and early 50s, not over the age of 55. Also, of looming importance is something you may or may not be aware of. It's called Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D is probably the biggest change in Medicare we've seen since the program began. That's the part that we're going to have a pharmaceutical benefit for the Medicare patients, patients over 65 primarily, some who are disabled also. This is going to happen in less than 6 months. It's going to start January 1st. People are getting letters right now that they're going to have a change in how they get their prescriptions. And the confusion is unbelievable. We're going to go through 6 months or a year of people having a very difficult time getting their drugs because of that confusion. Remember, many of these people are in their 70s and 80s. Just keeping track of their medications is difficult for them. Taking part in this very complex program that Medicare D has in it is going to be difficult. in my particular area, the people who are running this program, the program for the pharmaceutical industry, are already stepping up and starting to help those people to get ready for that program. So this network we have out there is one part of helping people get through this Medicare Part D situation. You will be receiving, I hope, before the session's out, a packet explaining Medicare Part D, because you will be receiving questions, I'm sure, from your constituents about what the heck is going on with their prescriptions. And it's going to be very complex, and even myself as a physician, I am now a little confused on what some of these things look like. There's going to be programs out there. They have to buy into the program. They have a penalty if they don't buy in right away. And there's a donut hole in the middle of it after $2,500 of how much you get, and it goes on and on and on. So and the bottom line is that this kind of program can help us get through that the first 6 months of the year when the confusion is going to reign the worst. So I would strongly recommend the Dash 12s. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions, committee members?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, this looks like it's an optional thing. It authorizes but doesn't require the establishment of a patient assistance program. Is there any need for fiscal analysis on this, given that it's an optional thing that we're not requiring?
No. Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, no, this is optional. We believe the funding will be raised by private funds to run the program and to get it going statewide. We've had some indication of the pharmaceutical industry they're going to help us out on this. There will be no fiscal audit for the state. There will be no cost to the state.
Yeah, if I could add to that, Representative McPherson, we have been in discussions with the industry about seeking grants to help fund the program. You know, you have two challenges when you when you work with a prescription drug program. The one challenge is to fund the administration of the program. The other challenge is to get the information out to the public, the people who would benefit from such a program, and basically advertise the program, sell the program. And so the funds that we would seek in terms of grants would help get the program out to the most amount of people as possible. You contrast that to our experience with the Oregon Prescription Drug Program right now, which we passed Representative Greenlick's bill from the 2003 session, Senate Bill 875. We've signed up just under 3,000 people, but there's 50,000 slots available. And one of the struggles there is to advertise the program and get the word out and let people know that they're eligible.
And if I might add to that, Representative Krieger, in this particular program now, there's over 100,000 people in the program with over 250,000 prescriptions being given out each month. This is a big program run by the pharmaceutical industry, and it is working, and this just facilitates it and prepares us partially for Medicare Part D.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anything further? Okay, thank you. Senator Cruz, were you just listening, or do you want to testify?
Oh, I'd love to speak.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to hang around for the Dash 13s when you get to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. Both the original bill, 818, and what is now the B-12 amendments were fully vetted and fully supported in the Senate. They are both very good works, and I would highly recommend the bill and the Dash 12s. Representative Dalto said he was going to stick around for the 13s. I just saw them this morning, Mr. Chair. I think the 13s attempt to change the world as we know it. There may be some laudable things in there. At this point in time, this late in the session, we have a bill and an amendment, both fully vetted, both widely supported, and I think it would be in our best interest, Mr. Chair, it would be my recommendation that you pass the bill with the B-12s only. While I would agree that the B-13s, there is certainly merit there, I think it is incredibly broad and incredibly comprehensive, and something that should take a lot more time than we are willing to give it, than we have the ability to give it at this point in time. I would, in my opinion, think that this would be probably job one for an interim committee to explore changes in the way we handle the system. I will admit that there are probably problems and issues we need to deal with, but Mr. Chair, the Senate Bill 818 with the B-13 amendments are both good public policy, and I would hate to see them put at risk.
Any questions, comments? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to change panels. Bruce Goldberg and Arthur Towers, if you'd like to come up.
For the record, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, I'm the administrator of the Office for Health Policy and Research, and I am here to speak to the B-12s. I worked with Jim Gardner, Senator Bates, Representative Dalto, and a number of individuals to help craft Senate Bill 598, which in essence is what you have before you in the B-12 amendments. And I worked through that, and I think that it's a great thing to help get indigent people in our state access to low-cost meds. However, I come before you today to say that it's really inadequate as a standalone piece, and I'd like to echo what Senator Bates said. What Senate Bill 598 does is it allows us to work with the pharmaceutical industry to get people what in essence are third, fourth, and fifth line medicines for free, which is a great thing, and I think that we should do that. However, I'm a physician, and what I know is that individuals can't get access to all the medicines that they need through these programs. That these programs don't help people get generic drugs, they don't help people get first and second line therapies for their illnesses. And so I think this bill is a great piece, but I think that it would really help if we could combine this by taking the age limit off of the prescription drug purchasing pool, thereby setting up a dual mechanism whereby we can help individuals in the state get access to low-cost generic first-line therapies, and at the same time help those people that need it get access to third- and fourth-line drugs. And by doing this, I believe that we can really do a service to the what is now almost 1 million people in our state who either have no prescription drug coverage or inadequate prescription drug coverage and need that help. I'm happy to answer any questions or hear any admonishments that you've got for me today.
We'll go on to Arthur first.
Chair Volquist, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And I wanted to speak to the -13s. I find myself in pretty complete agreement with Senator Cruz. Representative Dalto, the sponsor of the amendments, has done just a really good job over the course of the session, delving into the issues addressed here. He's really worked hard to include people into the decision-making process and to give an opportunity to have a wide variety of discussion on this. However, these amendments come before you without that sort of opportunity being provided on the specifics. We're concerned that while there may be a lot of good ideas in here, that there really does need to be a full vetting of the proposed amendments. So we just want to raise that concern today. Thank you very much.
Okay. Committee members, any questions, comments?
Just I guess this is a question for both of you. Recognizing this doesn't go as far as it should, when you look at the B-12s, but if this were what we were able to do, would it be worth doing or not? I guess that's the question.
I think it's Chair Krieger and Representative McPherson, we have a crisis in this state whereby we've hundreds of thousands of people who don't have access to medicines. Anything that we can do is a step in the right direction. And I would never sit before you and say we fall on some political... I'm a physician. I'd never fall on my political sword and jeopardize one or two people getting something that they need. We've got to do all that we can. So it would be a good thing. I, however, think we can do better and should do better.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anything further? Thank you. Can Mickey Cerise come up, please?
Hi, Chair Krieger and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services in the area of children, adults, and families. Our program area covers child welfare, and I'd like to speak briefly to the Senate Bill 818B-13 amendments. In fact, I was in the back of the room just reviewing these amendments. They do appear to be similar to amendments that were earlier considered for this particular piece of legislation. As Senator Cruz mentioned, I would like to reiterate and support his comments. This appears to me at this point to be a very good piece of legislation in terms of concepts for the child welfare system. This seems to represent a fairly comprehensive gathering of information that the department has heard from sources such as the Wayne Holder report, that was the national expert, the CERT reviews that are going on that were assigned by the governor back in October, the interim committee hearings that took place before this legislative session, and also during Representative Dalto's child welfare subcommittee, as well as individual constituent concerns that we've heard from a number of your offices. So I think this is a compilation of some trends that we were noticing in child welfare. By and large, the department has made several changes in a number of these areas, and the department is continuing to work on several other areas that are listed here. So we agree in concept. The only concern that I would have is I'm not an attorney, and I don't know if the exact language that would appear in statute would cause unintended consequences in other parts of the statute or the way that we practice now. I know when we, as an agency, try to analyze former amendments as they were written, we were having a little bit of difficulty in that some of it appeared unclear to us on duties and who would be responsible for what and what exactly was meant. So we had some trouble coming up with even a fiscal impact. We do know there would be a fiscal impact in certain areas, such as a 1-800 toll-free number. We don't know if that would be something that we could use that's already in place and not consider that to be increased. So we came up with a couple of fiscals, one that we could just simply operate as is and have all calls coming into the current existing system. The second fiscal that we looked at in that particular area was the expected increase of calls coming in and the number of staff that we would need to man those calls. So without some clarification in some of the areas, I'm a little hesitant to say that they're an exact number in terms of a fiscal impact, although we did the best that we could in working up some of those numbers. I also agree with Senator Cruz's comment that by and large, what you're reading in these amendments, I think, are good public policy. I think these are things that the Assistant Director, Ramona Foley, has mentioned a number of times in a number of forums and has been supportive and, as I mentioned, has been working on for over the last 2 to 3 years. I also agree with Senator Cruz that this is a very complex program area, even though from a fiscal point of view it represents a very small part of the DHS budget. It's one of the few programs that you have in your districts that when we offer a service, We knock on your client's door, your constituent's door. We don't wait for them to come into us. So it does make it a little bit different program. And because of that, we have significant oversight, and we have significant involvement with community partners. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Committee members, do you have any comments, questions? Thank you, Mickey. Was there anyone else here on 818 that didn't get signed up? Okay. We're having a minor glitch with 818. We're going to close the work session from now. We may come back to it at 1 o'clock. I want to get some clarification on the amendments. We'll close the work session on 818. And we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 995. Mr. Taylor, what does this bill do?
A good bill to pass, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clay, I'm going to get there. Thank you, Mr. Members of the Committee. Exempt State Treasurer and Secretary of State from state personal relations law requires State Treasurer and Secretary of State to adopt a system for personal administration.
Okay, how about Jesse, is it Cornett, Cynthia Barnes, and Linda Hagland, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Hagland, Deputy State Treasurer. As the committee administrator indicated, this bill clarifies the practices that have been in place between DAS and the Secretary of State and the Office of the State Treasurer for about the last 60 years. And really, the reason that we're here is to clarify statute, and it's based on a legal analysis. And for that, and for the efficiency of the committee, I'd like to ask Cynthia Burns to run through that history. I think that might be the most instructive for you.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cynthia Burns. I'm with the Attorney General's Office, and I'm the attorney that represents the Office of the State Treasurer. I'm here mostly just to answer some questions, if you have any, and give you a brief background. I did some research on the legislative history of the Treasury statutes and their relationship to the Department of Administrative Services personnel rules. As you know, the Treasurer's Office and the Secretary of State are constitutional offices, and they operate independently within the executive branch of government. In the early 1950s, there were a series of opinions that were issued by our office in conjunction with the formation of what was then called the Department of Administrative Services and Finance about the relationship between those offices, and we advised that the Secretary of State and Treasurer had a reporting duty to the rest of the executive branch and the governor's office, but were to operate mostly independently in the performance of their duties. And because of that, you've seen historically a number of statutes that say when they define a state agency and they apply to every agency of state government except the legislative branch, the judiciary, and the offices of the Secretary of State and the Treasurer. And those are all sort of, I think, based on that old 1950s advice. Well, over the years, the parties have operated largely independently with respect to their personnel administration of their offices and the Department of Administrative Services. But the State Civil Service Act, which is codified in Chapter 240, has over the years blossomed and bloomed into a rather convoluted structure of personnel administration, and along with that has become a little convoluted with respect to its relationship to the Treasurer and the Secretary of State's offices. So what this bill does, instead of trying to clarify Chapter 240 and probably make it even more convoluted in the process, is to remove them from most of the provisions of Chapter 240, except a few with respect to the Employee Relations Board and things like that, and have them doing what they've been doing, I understand, for many, many years, which is operate their independent personnel systems on a merit basis, which is like the DAS system. And so what this is doing is trying to codify the way the parties have historically interacted and remove them from some of the inadvertent provisions of Chapter 240. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Committee member, do you have any questions? Guess not. Thank you.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse Cornett. I'm the legislative liaison for the Secretary of State's office, and I will try to be brief as well. Both the Treasurer's Office and DOJ have testified, Senate Bill 995 clarifies the rules of our offices in relation to personnel issues. Senate Bill 995 would preserve the current relationship our office has with DAS as it pertains by exempting us from the statutes. We currently observe ORS 240, and it's our intention to continue to do so. We, you know, are keeping in line with state government practices, not deviating from that. But what we seek by this bill and what it provides is clarity under that statute. And I would also be happy to answer any questions should you have them. Thank you.
If I can make just a closing comment, to be clear, Mr. Chair, the bill itself does not affect any of our classified employees that are covered by bargaining agreements. So this is only for management and unclassified staff in our respective agencies.
Okay, anything further? Just a follow-up question on that, Mr. Chair, Ms. Hagelin, and if we can bounce this to one of the others if need be. That's what I've been told consistently, is that it does not apply to classified employees. I'm just looking at the language of the bill and the cross-references in it, and I didn't quite understand how that worked mechanically. How is it that it's limited to just the exempt employees or non-classified employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the bill by its terms covers the scope of classified employees. It takes the Treasury's employees with respect to those certain classifications out of ORS Chapter 240 and has the Treasurer's Office adopting his own merit-based personnel system, which could include and probably would include the same classifications. What it doesn't do is change the way they've operated in practice over the years, and it retains in with for many years the Treasurer's Office for represented employees has bargained through DAS through an agreement, and then those employees have, if they have a grievance, have appeal rights through ERB and things like that. So those are what when you see the statutes that say the reference in section 2 subsection 3 that says except as provided in subsection 4, chapter 240 does not apply, and then subsection 4 lists a series of statutes, and those are the statutes that talk about the contract for represented employees, the ability to continue to use ERB, and what's the other one? I'm sorry, I had these written on some notes and I couldn't find them when I came here. Right, and that they can use DAS. They sometimes do salary studies to see how classified and unclassified and management salaries play out, and they can continue to use those sorts of services with DAS.
Yeah, follow up if I could. It looks to me like it's the cross-reference to 240.321, which is collective bargaining. So again, what that's telling us is that because that's not in the exemption that this bill is undertaking, that then both offices would still be subject to collective bargaining for their classified employees.
Right. That relationship would continue under which they have a contract with DAS, and DAS bargains on behalf of Treasury with the collective bargaining units, and then those appeal rights and other things would continue to apply like they have.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Clarified, okay?
Yeah.
Any further questions? Comments? Okay, I have a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, move SB 995A to the floor with a due pass.
Thank you. Representative Volquist has moved Senate Bill 9958 of the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Volquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 995 moves the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative McPherson, would you care?
Be happy to.
Thank you. Close the work session on that. No, we've got permission to move here. Maybe all of them called back up. We had clarification on the dash 13 that I was concerned about. We're going to reopen a work session on Senate Bill 18.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the B-12 amendment into SB 818B.
Representative Volquist has moved the B-12 amendments into Senate Bill 818B. Any discussion? Objections? Therein?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the B-13 amendments into SB 818B.
Representative Volquist has moved the B-13 amendments into Senate Bill 818B. Any objections? Discussion?
We just got these, of course, this morning, and I'm trying to get through them. And it does appear pretty complicated in just a little bit of time. I've had to look at this. And I would really tend to agree with Senator Cruz that, a lot of this sounds pretty good, but the department can't even give us a fiscal. They don't know what it's going to cost, and there's other things in there. I'm really concerned that this may sink the entire bill.
Representative Cruz and Dolfo talked to leadership, and evidently they're putting something together for conference. If it does go there, that they're going to work it out. I think they've got an answer. So that you know.
I still have a lot of heartache with this one. Just in
any other objections to those?
Yeah, no, I will join General Representative Barker and his concerns about the bill, about the amendment, A-13.
So noted. And anything further?
I do have concerns as well as expressed by numbers of folks. I will give a courtesy vote.
Okay, so noted. The B-13, sir. And then just a second. A motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move SB 818 to budget.
The Volquist has moved 818 as amended to the Budget Committee with a due pass. Any further discussion? Hearing none, take the roll.
Representative Barker?
No. No.
Representative Volquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 818 has moved to budget with a due pass, and we do not need a carrier. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 818, and we will recess until possibly 1 o'clock. We may have some more bills. So be available, please.
We have a caucus at 1, but we'll be here.
Thank you. On state and federal affairs. Let me see. Let's take and do a work session on Senate Bill 1097.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1097 comes to you from Senator Peter Courtney, and the bill permits the Department of Human Services for the purpose of interment or creation of a memorial to release the name, date of birth, and date of death of a person whose remains are still in the possession of the state. Declares an emergency, and the bill is effective upon the passage.
Is there anybody wanting to testify on this bill? It's kind of the Grim Reaper bill. It needs to happen, Gordon.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 1097 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Volquist has moved Senate Bill 1097 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections, comments?
Consent.
Call the roll, please.
Can we get on consent?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Volquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1097 moves the floor with a due pass. Now, who can I have carry this?
I'll carry it if it can't go on consent.
You want to carry it?
If it's quicker to get it on, I'll just carry it.
Yeah, it's got to go on. It's faster than consent.
Okay, I'll carry it. That's fine.
Okay, Representative Bocas will carry.
I seem to have a lot of dead bills on it.
Do we know how long the waiver for Senator Deckard might be found? Is he in the building? Do you know?
I didn't call. Biggest call.
Okay, let's just stand at ease for just a couple of minutes.
You don't have copies of the bill, do you?
We also have Senator Corley coming up 301 in a few minutes.
844. I have the bill. I have the bill file here.
And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 301. And we'll have Pete Shepherd come up, please.
Here, I'll take you. I'll take those two.
Representative Pearson, Okay. All right, my apologies. Are you ready for a summary?
Before we start, Pete, I'm going to have a brief summary, and then I'll go ahead and you have your hand.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 301 is sponsored by Senator Avell Gordley. It is the Attorney General's use of force bill that creates planning authorities in each counties that are responsible for drafting plans regarding issues surrounding officer use of deadly force incidents. If the those plans are to be submitted to the Attorney General, and if the Attorney General determines that those plans are in compliance with this bill, there are grant funds that are to be allocated through the Attorney General to the local planning authorities for implementation of those plans. The Senate Budget Committee has approved a total of $300,000 for these grant programs. The other provisions of the measure have to do with the minimum guidelines that law enforcement agencies would be required to adopt regarding deadly use of force by its officers. They include providing two sessions of mental health counseling with each officer involved in the use of deadly force. It's a prohibition from having an officer return to a situation where the officer may have to be in a situation where they use deadly force. And it also prohibits law enforcement agencies from taking sole responsibility for the investigation of a use of deadly force incident within their agency. There's a data collection provision. The data about these incidents is to be submitted to the Attorney General. And then there are also provisions regarding grand jury and inquest. The measure permits district attorneys to present facts surrounding such an incident to the grand jury. The grand jury proceeding is required to be transcribed, and there is a presumption that can be overcome that the transcript of the grand jury proceeding should be released to the public under certain conditions. The presumption can be overcome if any of the officers involved, the witnesses of the grand jury, persuade the court that the public interest in disclosure is outweighed by their interest in privacy, potential prejudice to the prosecution, or there's one other factor, the officer's or a witness's right to a fair trial. The other thing that happens in this bill is that the inquest provision is amended slightly to make clear that an inquest cannot be convened. An inquest is basically like a public grand jury, if you will, but the issue is not whether anyone's going to be charged. It's just to have a public hearing over what occurred. And the inquest cannot happen under this bill until the officer's potential criminal liability is resolved. That is so as not to jeopardize the officer's potential rights as a criminal defendant. And that inquest provision actually sunsets under this bill in 2007, so there would be no more provision for an inquest. There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means that came with the bill. There is also a B4 amendment that was requested by Representative Barker. The B4 amendment takes out the sections regarding the transcription and making public the grand jury transcript, and it also adds a provision that I believe was actually in the original bill that requires the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to provide a detailed training to officers with respect to investigation of officer use of force incidents.
Thank you. Senator Gordley.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Frankly, I need to catch my breath. And what I'd like to do is defer to Mr. Pete Shepherd from the Attorney General's office to lead off, and then I will follow.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're always anxious to help out a member, even if it's only to help her catch her breath. So pleased to be here this morning. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. As your staff has aptly summarized, this bill comes to you as the result of a extremely comprehensive and deep inquiry into an issue that is of great significance to communities throughout Oregon and also to law enforcement agencies and to individual police officers. Because the B4 amendments accept most of most elements of the bill, I won't burden the committee with a comprehensive review of the other parts of the bill, except to give you a little bit of an idea of a key element of the process that results in the printed bill that's before you, and then very briefly talk about the grand jury inquest provisions of the printed bill, because it's that aspect of the B4 amendments that I think represents the most significant policy choice for this committee this afternoon. The Attorney General does strongly support the printed bill, and it does result from the comprehensive process that I've described. One very important part of that process is that in addition to the very broad-based working group, the members of which included virtually every imaginable person or interest group that might have an interest in these issues, ranging from the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, district attorneys, police chiefs, line officers, representatives of unions representing officers, officers from every part of the state, direct involvement of individuals whose family members died as a result of law enforcement action or as a result of being involved in circumstances in which officers were compelled to take the life of the family member. Those we had in the working group, which met on numerous occasions prior to the beginning of the session, I think every possible perspective on this issue. One of the things that we realized in doing this very early in the process is that while the newspaper headlines may well focus on the effect on the community of one of these incidents, the fact is that the officers involved are dramatically affected as individuals and as persons whose official duties include, pursuant to state law and to the duty of their employment, unfortunately, sometimes the obligation to take a life. And when that occurs, there are profound consequences for the individual officer as well as for the community. And so we realized that in a group setting that included a whole bunch of different folks, we weren't going to get the full flavor of those impacts on officers. And so the Attorney General arranged through the good offices of several of the unions involved in these issues to meet separately and after hours with groups of police officers, each of whom had themselves been involved in one or more incident in which their duties obliged them to take a life. And on two occasions, we met exclusively with groups of officers like that, and on a third occasion, we met in a larger group that included officers who had been in those circumstances. And one of the things that we heard from those officers very clearly and very explicitly was that the public inquest proceeding that on very rare occasions, but nonetheless on occasion, has been invoked in order to provide the community with a window on the events that occurred. That process was universally, and I think it's not too strong to say, despised by the officers who themselves had been involved in incidents which had been submitted to an inquest jury, and really reviled by other officers who faced the prospect of being confronted in an inquest proceeding with a public examination of their conduct. Some of the officers, for instance, described to us that as being like being put on trial for doing my duty. And so we heard that, and in the report we recommended that the Legislative Assembly during the interim look carefully at the question of whether inquest juries should be continued at all. And then we met after the first hearing on this bill in the Senate further with officers and with others, and we concluded that this was an appropriate time to amend the bill to include the elimination of the inquest jury. And so the bill as it comes before you, as your staff has described, will cause the inquest proceeding to be unavailable or inaccessible in circumstances in which officers use deadly physical force and cause of death, beginning in 2007, I believe is the date. And that recognizes a very distinct quality of inquest juries that's different qualities than from a grand jury examination of the officer's conduct. An inquest jury takes place in real time in a public forum, and some of these inquests even have been televised. So one of the things we heard, for example, with respect to at least one of the inquests recently that had been conducted, and I should say these are not exclusively in Multnomah County, although that is the forum in which the most recent event occurred. Because this was taking place in real time on television, what can happen is that the testimony that appears to be adverse to the officer's determination appears on day one of the inquest proceeding. And so everything that is reported about what was testified to on day one of that inquest proceeding rolls out before the public in real time and then is reported the next morning in the newspaper without the officer or other people having had yet the opportunity to give their testimony that presents a more complete picture of what might have transpired. And so that's one important difference between inquest juries and grand juries, because grand juries take place in confidence. They are secret unless and until that secrecy is breached pursuant to the proposal that you have before you in the printed bill. The other thing that happens in inquest juries, and another thing that we heard about them that made them very much less desirable than the grand jury process, is that they are essentially uncontrolled. That is to say, there isn't a process, an understood process, for using the inquest jury in the circumstances that arise when an officer uses deadly physical force. Inquest juries are not designed to determine that. Historically, they're designed to determine the cause and manner of death. They're not designed to be a forum that generates a record through which the community can make independent judgments and transparent judgments about the conduct of their public servants. And in contrast, the grand jury proceeding is focused on a particular issue. Did the officer commit a crime in using deadly physical force? Or to put it another way, was the officer's use of deadly physical force justified under all the circumstances? And so the judgment that the Attorney General reached and that the Senate concurred in was that the community's interest in understanding exactly what happened and having an independent view of what happened under all the circumstances would better be satisfied by recording a grand jury transcript of the testimony presented in the grand jury and developed under the supervision of the district attorney than it is by conducting inquest juries in public. And so the judgment that's represented in the printed bill and the difference between it and the B4s in substantive part is that both the B4s and the printed bill eliminate the inquest jury effectively in 2007. But the B4s also eliminate the part of the printed bill which requires a district attorney to cause a transcription of a grand jury presentation concerning an officer's use of deadly physical force that caused a death. The B4s eliminate that part of the bill. The printed bill is supported by the Attorney General. The Attorney General opposes that part of the B4s that would eliminate the recordation of grand jury under the circumstances that I've described. And let me suggest a couple of reasons why the Attorney General supports this limited opening of the grand jury transcript to community examination after the grand jury has reached its conclusion. First, the grand jury recordation provisions of the printed bill only apply to circumstances in which an officer's use of deadly force results in death. They do not apply in any other circumstance that examines any other conduct of the officer. So, for example, if a district attorney chooses to submit to a grand jury a matter involving an officer's use of deadly physical force that didn't result in a death, there's no requirement under the bill that a transcription of the testimony be presented. Second, under the bill, the grand jury transcript, although presumptively to be released to the public, is nevertheless protected from public view under a variety of conditions, some of which can be asserted directly by the officer whose conduct was involved, and others of which can be asserted by the district attorney. One of those conditions your committee counsel has referred to already, and that is that a petition to keep the grand jury transcript confidential, secret, is allowed, and the court may grant that petition if the probable prejudice to the right of a witness who appeared before the grand jury or of an officer who was involved in the incident would be prejudiced in respect to a fair trial. And so if an officer were, and this has not occurred in any of in any recent memory in Oregon, and by recent I mean 30 years or so, if an officer were to be charged with a homicide as a result of the unlawful use of deadly physical force, and that matter were to be presented to the grand jury under this bill, and the grand jury proceedings were to be recorded or transcribed, that officer could seek protection from the court against the public release of that, because the public release of that transcript potentially could prejudice that officer's right to a fair trial if he or she were to be charged with a crime. And so this is a limited intrusion into the grand jury secrecy provision. The Oregon Register Guard's editorial I provided to you, and I won't burden you with reading a provision of that to you. It's on the reverse of the circle diagram that's been distributed to you. However, I would commend to you the paragraph that discussed the transcription of the grand jury requirement. Members of the committee, the Attorney General could not support the B4 amendments, but if they were included in the bill, the Attorney General would oppose the result. And the reason for that is that fundamentally the use of deadly physical force is an act that takes place on the community's behalf and under authority granted by the community. It is something that we ask officers to undertake as part of their duties as officers. It is not solely an issue that has consequences for the officer. And if we eliminate the grand jury recordation and we eliminate the inquest proceeding, then the mechanisms for the public to be reassured that there has been an independent examination of the issue are greatly diminished. And the public cannot see the record, the carefully developed record, upon which judgments about making criminal charges might be made. Now, the public would still have accessible to it under the printed bill. In many jurisdictions, the district attorney makes a written statement regarding his or her determination about the use of deadly force by the officer and accompanies that statement with a public release of the investigative record that's been generated by investigators. And that still would be available, and indeed in some jurisdictions, district attorneys and local communities might determine that their plan does not include the use of the grand jury recordation process. So it is possible that even under the printed bill, there would be some jurisdictions that choose not to send these matters to grand jury and thus choose not to generate any of that kind of a controlled written record. But the Attorney General would oppose a bill that included the B-4s in that respect. The Attorney General supports the portion of the B-4s that relates to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and enhancing their mandate to do training, because that is a very key element of this, as the executive summary of the Attorney General's report indicates, and as we've said in testimony on this bill in the Senate. And so we support that portion of the B-4s, which basically is Section 22 of the B-4 amendments. And with that, I would stand available for questions or for Senator Gordley's testimony.
Senator Gordley, do you want to speak first or let him be questioned first?
I would enjoy speaking now. I feel that I have arrived, finally arrived. And I do apologize for my delay in arriving. Senate Bill 301B emerges as a result of a great deal of work by citizens, by community leaders, by law enforcement agencies, and by the Office of Attorney General Hardy Myers, who, in my opinion and that of many others, has provided outstanding leadership in getting us to this day. This measure builds on legislation first proposed by this senator in 1995 and on further proposals by former Senator John Menas, working together with Senator Carter and myself last session. And this measure is also the result of years of advocacy by the Albina Ministerial Alliance, who requested that the issue of police use of deadly force be addressed by this legislature. Senate Bill 301 emerges also as a result of enormous pain suffered by victims, by families of victims, by law enforcement officers and their families, and by the community itself, the sort of pain that results from the sudden loss of life in dramatic and unexpected circumstances. This bill is also about the sort of pain that arises when a law enforcement officer takes a life, the pain that courses through that officer and his or her family, the pain the officer and his or her fellow officers carry with them as they get about moving on and continuing to do their jobs. This measure is deeply informed by that pain and by its impact on the community. This measure does not seek to assign blame to police officers who have exercised lethal force. We are aware of the emotional impact, again, that these officers and their families suffer, and we seek through this legislation to establish policies that reduce the incidence of police-involved shootings, that provide for improved training, that yield the transparency that families and communities need when these tragedies occur, and that help both the public and law enforcement to understand each other more clearly. I especially want to acknowledge the contributions made by the police officers who shared their experiences and their personal pain in order to help the task force more fully understand the impact of the use of deadly force on the lives of law enforcement professionals and their families. This public policy a statewide issue is made better by their contributions. This proposed legislation and its implementation is our opportunity to strengthen the administration of justice in the state of Oregon, and it is an acknowledgement that the citizens of our state desire to enhance the training that our fine, dedicated public safety professionals receive. The bottom line is that there is no current statutory requirement for Oregon police agencies to develop a use of force policy. And there are some agencies that operate without having any use of force policy at all. And this fact creates enormous uncertainty and opportunities for misunderstanding at every point in the cycles of events that occur prior to, during, and after incidents involving the use of lethal force. Speaking to the bill, the bill places in statute requirements that all police and sheriff departments in Oregon engage in the planning process and adopt guidelines regarding the use of deadly force. The bill provides for an explicit advance planning process, and again, under current state law, no advance planning process is required. Section 2 of the bill creates in each county a deadly physical force planning authority. The planning authority shall develop a plan consisting of the following, and I will outline the elements. An element dealing with education, outreach, and training regarding the use of deadly physical force for police officers. Attorneys employed by state or local governments within the county and members of the community. An element dealing with the immediate aftermath of an incident in which a police officer used deadly physical force. An element dealing with the investigation of an incident in which a police officer used deadly physical force. An element dealing with the exercise of district attorney discretion to resolve issues of potential criminal responsibility resulting from a police officer's use of deadly force. An element dealing with collecting information regarding a police officer's use of deadly force, debriefing after an incident in which a police officer used deadly physical force, and revising a plan developed under this subsection based on experience. And then there's also an estimate of the fiscal impact on the law enforcement agencies to which the plan applies of each element described in this legislation. I would say here that the Senate, in looking at this particular aspect of the legislation, recommended appropriating $300,000 general fund to the Department of Justice for reimbursing law enforcement agencies for their activities in carrying out the plan required by this bill. The bill provides financial incentives, as I've just described, for law enforcement agencies to participate in the planning process. We know that some agencies provide mental health supports for officers who were the physical cause of death or who ordered the use of deadly force, and some agencies do not. Senate Bill 301 provides for state-subsidized mental health support for all qualifying Oregon law enforcement professionals. Under current statute, no law protects officers from being immediately returned to service after having exercised lethal force. Senate Bill 301 prohibits returning highly traumatized officers to anything other than light-duty service before at least 72 hours have elapsed. The bill also addresses the conduct of investigations following the use of deadly force, prohibiting any agency from taking sole responsibility for the investigation of one of its own officers. Currently, the cost of complying with federal data collection mandates involving lethal force are borne by the local agency, and under this bill, those costs are subsidized by the state. Mr. Shepard referred to the editorial in the Eugene Register Guard, which speaks to the issue of allowing for a level of public scrutiny in the grand jury process. And what I would do here is just read directly from the bill, Section 10, for the use of deadly physical force by a police officer that results in the death of a person requires a level of public scrutiny that uniquely justifies limited, I'm going to place the emphasis on limited, intrusions into the secrecy historically accorded grand jury proceedings. And with that said, and you can read the rest of that editorial on your own, I would just add that currently the only way that the public has a way of getting detailed information about a deadly force incident is through a civil lawsuit. Again, this gives us a window in those limited circumstances where these tragedies occur. This bill also addresses the roles of the grand jury and the coroner's inquest, as you've heard from Mr. Shepard, following lethal force incidents, offering better transparency in the process, and providing certainty where now there is virtually none. Under this bill, an officer's grand jury testimony is inadmissible in any subsequent civil or administrative action. Currently, there is great reluctance to provide testimony due to the risk involved, resulting in the loss of opportunity to learn from these tragic events. Under current law found in ORS 132.330, a district attorney may bring a case to the grand jury only when the department has, quote, good reason to believe that a crime has been committed, end of quote. This understandably creates a bar to the administration of justice in that it unfairly creates a climate of prejudice against the officer or officers involved. Under Senate Bill 301, a district attorney is allowed to present deadly force incidents, including shoot-miss incidents, to a grand jury without the presumption that the officer has committed a crime. No principle under current law prevents a district attorney from convening a coroner's inquest at any time. Under Senate Bill 301, regarding use of lethal force incidents, after a phase-in period that ends July of 2007, no inquest may be convened before an officer's criminal culpability is decided, as you heard described and defined by Mr. Shepard. The assumption is that counties will have moved forward to enact plans and officers will have participated in the enhanced use of force training at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Remember, colleagues, we're now moving from 10 weeks of training to 16 weeks of training, which will still be far below the national standard, which is 22 weeks of training. But that enhanced training at the academy will now include scenarios around use of deadly force, scenarios around dealing with the mentally ill, scenarios around dealing with gang-affected youth, scenarios involving acts of terror. Again, we're talking about elements of training, components of training that are being added to the academy that did not exist before. Lastly, and I will move to close. This bill does not change what has happened in the past. It does not provide the explanations that those who've lost family members and loved ones are seeking. It doesn't remove the chaos that has intruded into the lives of police officers and their families in the aftermath of an incident involving lethal force. But the bill does establish some degree of assurance that other families and police officers in future incidents will not suffer as these have. And that is how this bill also operates, to help heal deep wounds impacting our communities today. And so I believe that it is vital and necessary that we move this legislation without the amendments as our contribution to that healing. And I thank you, Mr. Chair, and colleagues, for your attention. And for the record, I am Avell Gordley, Senate District 23. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, may I make one piece of legislative history that Senator Gordley alluded to, and I promised that I would, I promised the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office that I would do this. It's very brief. Mr. Chair, Section 8 of the bill, Senator Gordley alluded to, it amends the existing statute regarding the circumstances under which district attorneys may present matters to a grand jury by adding a new subsection that provides expressly that the district attorney may present facts to the grand jury about an incident in which a police officer used deadly physical force. The implication is, Senator Gordley saying, represented that this is not intended, it's intended to make it clear that the district attorney may submit matters to the grand jury without an implication of criminal conduct by the officer. The addition to this is not meant to be by, in our presentation, and this also was a part of the record on the Senate, the addition of this provision is not to foreclose the practice common in some jurisdictions now of submitting other kinds of matters to the grand jury without the district attorney necessarily having a particular expectation that an indictment will result. It's not uncommon for district attorneys to present matters in which there's sharply conflicting testimony, for instance, to a grand jury and let the grand jury work its will on the resolution of credibility that might be involved. And so by adding this additional authorization, we're not intending to create in the existing law a different interpretation of existing law.
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to start out by both complimenting Senator Gordley and, through Mr. Shepard, the Attorney General Myers for undertaking what's a very difficult effort here to try to reconcile these and, you know, I think, strongly held concerns about both from the part of the community when one of these events occurs and by law enforcement, who I think rightly feel as though they're put out there doing a difficult job and under called into question after the fact. I wanted to focus, and I'll put this question to Mr. Shepard. I see that the original bill required that a use of deadly force incident would be required to be presented to the grand jury, and that the B engrossed version we have before today is now as a may. The district attorney may present facts to the grand jury. And what I'm going to the issue that's raised by the B4 amendments, what I'm wondering about is, since it's an optional matter in the hands of the DA, whether or not the facts of the incident will be presented, is the mechanism of releasing the transcript of those proceedings likely to have a chilling effect on that decision by the DA to hold such a proceeding? Are we likely with this configuration where it's an option to go into that process, mm-hmm. but then there's subject to the possibility of there being of sealing the record, the proceeding would become public? Is that likely to become an unused kind of process?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me start the answer to Representative McPherson's question by describing what the current practice is around the state, and that is it's very extremely variable from county to county. Some district attorneys have a nearly ironclad rule that they never submit anything to grand jury and they never convene inquest juries. And in those counties, the district attorney's practice is to gather together the results of the investigation and then to make a public pronouncement of the district attorney's assessment of the criminal culpability of the officer or officers involved. I say never because, as I earlier testified, in recent years, no district attorney in Oregon has reached the conclusion that the officer was culpable, presumably even in those counties that do not ordinarily present matters to the grand jury. If a district attorney concluded that an officer was criminally culpable, then of course there would be a submission to the grand jury. But barring that kind of case, there are counties that never submit matters to the grand jury at all. There are other counties that in which the district attorney makes an evaluation of the results of the investigation, and based on that evaluation makes a case-by-case determination as to whether the matter is one that he or she should submit to a grand jury or alternatively to an inquest. And then there are other counties that have universal policies that they submit all such matters to the grand jury, whether or not the district attorney has previously reached a conclusion that the officer was culpable or was not culpable, criminally culpable under the circumstances. I think your question goes to whether a predictive one, what will the effect of these amendments be on those various practices? I think it's safe to say that the most certain effect is that even during the two-year period in which inquest juries will continue to be available, none will be convened. That is to say, as between an inquest jury and a grand jury proceeding which is recorded, I would wager quite a lot on the proposition that no district attorney will convene an inquest jury. The question then, the further predictive quality is, let's assume the elimination of inquest juries altogether. Now we're in the post-2007 period. Let's say the bill is in effect, which gives the option of presenting matters to the grand jury. My personal prediction is that presenting matters to the grand jury and preparing a transcript will become the near universal practice. Now, I have to say that many district attorneys disagree with that. Many say that they will continue their current practice and make a case-by-case determination about whether to submit it to the grand jury or not. And some others will continue with their current practice of never submitting the matter to the grand jury. I'll tell you the basis for my personal prediction is that I've conducted a number of recorded grand jury proceedings. Under existing law, the existing law permits a district attorney to record a grand jury proceeding provided that the district attorney provides for recordation of the entirety of the proceeding. Those grand jury proceedings then, the transcripts then, in my experience, become available to the defense counsel in the course of prosecuting the case. And I always found it advantageous to record the matter. Because the grand jury proceeding takes place under the entire control of the district attorney. He or she has total control over the order of presentation of witnesses and virtually total control over the manner in which those witnesses are questioned. Now, the statutes do provide limitations on the evidence admissible in those proceedings, and those are real, but they're also very broad, and they're under the direction of the attorney general or of the district attorney conducting the proceeding. I personally believe that most district attorneys will, when they get over the initial fear about changing the practice of recording grand jury testimony, because mostly it is not recorded under present practice, once they get over that initial anxiety, that they will find that to be a very superior forum for helping the community understand exactly why it is that the officers were in fact compelled under the circumstances of the case to use deadly force. But I would readily acknowledge to you that's just my projection, and I think candor requires that some DAs predict a different outcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barker, you and I had a conversation the other day, and it had to do with the chilling effect of potential witnesses if they didn't understand the law. But they're going to understand that certain portions of it through the grand jury might be made public. And that was the reason that they came forward. Mm-hmm. I think the rest of the bill is fine. I think it does a lot. I think adding the training or criteria piece at the training academy, I think that's an improvement.
That's we agree.
Where I'm from.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, may I address that question of chilling potential witnesses, because it's something we discussed early in the session when we began to discuss these issues, and something I've given a lot of thought to based on the bill and also based on my prior experience as a prosecutor involving a number of cases in which we had very reluctant witnesses. And again, this is, you can treat this as Peach Shepard's idiosyncratic view of that issue or not, but I think the first place where witness reluctance emerges and does emerge in this kind of an investigation or indeed in any other is not in the contemplation by the witness of the downstream process, but in the initial approach by the investigating officers to obtain information, because that is where the first contact between the official, the police officers, and the witness takes place. And, of course, nothing in the bill or in the B4 amendments changes in any way the characterization of the nature of that initial contact. There will still, under the B4s or under the bill, be a conversation in which the officer goes to a witness and says, perhaps doing a canvas of all the people who live in the apartment complex in the parking lot of which the incident occurs. There will still be people who will look at the officer and say, you know what, I've got to come back and live in this apartment tomorrow. If I give you a statement about this that tends to support what the officer did, there's going to be holy heck for me to pay with the people who live in apartment number 3B right next to me. Now, nothing about the B4s or the bill will change that dynamic. That will continue to exist. Now, one of the things that an officer can do at that point is say, look, when your testimony is presented to the grand jury proceeding is secret. But in candor, the officer also would have to say, the law requires the name of every witness who testified to be appended to the foot of the grand jury. I can't promise you that your neighbor won't find out that you've given me a statement. And really, in all candor, the officer also would have to say to that witness, I can commit to you that during the investigation, there are exemptions from the public records law that will prevent my report from being made public. But once, if there's a crime charged, if someone is charged with a crime as a result of this, or once the investigation is concluded, then I can't make the guarantee to you that your statement will be held confidential. And that will be as true under the B4s as it is under the engrossed version of the bill that comes to you. So the only incremental difference that I can see in providing for the mechanism that B4 provides with respect to the potential public release of the transcript is that when the investigating officer has that conversation with the witness, the officer will have to add a further condition, which is, if your testimony is presented to the grand jury in this matter, then it's possible that your testimony will be disclosed, and the law does provide for release of the transcript of that. Now, the question is does that dramatically add to the impediments to collect the information, and my judgment would be that it does not. I understand others might disagree, but
that's a concern I have as well, that the person today could go to the grand jury and say, yeah, they subpoenaed me, I came in and testified, but by God, I told them A, B, and C, and so when they really told them C, D, and F, and I have concerns about that. I do want to compliment Senator Gordy on the tremendous amount of work put into this product, and it's a grand improvement. I'm just stuck on the grand jury piece, but what a great job you've done heading that up and getting that going over the years, not this year, but over the years, and I appreciate that work. Any other further questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the B4s into SB 301.
Attorney Boquist has moved the B4 into Senate Bill 301. Any objections?
Mr. Chair, I will object to the befores on the ground that was discussed here with Senator Cordway and Mr. Shepard. Ordinarily, I would take the lead on, or follow the lead on the history that other committee members have who carried the badge and have been in harm's way and had to make these kinds of judgments. I do think that the process that's described here has enough protections in it that I would be willing to give it a try to see what its impacts are. I do have the concern that I mentioned about having a chilling effect on the use of this grand jury proceeding, but I'd be willing to try this out. I think this would be a good process to see how it goes. So I will register that objection to the B4s.
Okay. Any further objections? If not, the B4s are in.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move SB301B as amended down to Ways and Means. Would it do pass?
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 301B as amended and that it be referred to Ways and Means. Comments, objections?
Comment. Mr. Chair, I support the bill. I think it's a good product with or without the B4s, so I'm in favor of the bill, but just registered that one concern on that one issue.
Thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 301B has amended moved down to the Ways and Means process. Work session. As Senator Deckert, there he is. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 844. Senator Deckert. See if he remembers his first words.
Mr. Chair, Ryan Deckert, State Senator from Beaverton. Wolf, wolf.
Hey, you did it. We'd like you to tell us in a moment. I'm going to have staff talk to us a little bit about the bill, and then we'll go ahead and have you testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 844A was heard before the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee on June 1st and June 3rd. The bill creates classifications for dangerous and potentially dangerous dogs and modifies the authority for law enforcement officers, dog control boards, county governments, and courts relating to the impoundment and disposition of dangerous dogs, potentially dangerous dogs, and dogs deemed to be a public nuisance. It directs counties to create a registry for dogs determined to be dangerous and potentially dangerous, sets penalties for maintaining dangerous, potentially dangerous dogs, and modifies existing penalties for the same. The Agriculture Committee received on that last day that we heard the bill, -A4 amendments, which Senator Deckert's office produced. We had a large number of people in the room. I think we had 8 people at the dais. Everybody was on board, but it was determined we did not have the ability to take action on those amendments at this time. So those amendments have been provided in your packet, and I believe Senator Deck will be able to speak to those. The bill has no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having me here with you this afternoon on a beautiful Saturday afternoon. I can be relatively brief. This bill is one that has been worked very, very hard, and I'd like to thank the participants, which was just about everyone that interacts with animal issues in the state, and they may be seated in here, the counties, the cities. I don't see my team, the 8 that were with me. But it really was the bill that you have before you, and we do need the -4s, was in reflection of some incidences that we've had around the state where we've had some dog attacks on individuals and animals, and so that was where the bill originated from, and then thankfully we introduced a bill that was very breed specific about certain specific breeds of dogs, and working with the veterinarian community, Commissioner Soa, who kind of wore two hats on our group, one as a veterinarian and secondly as a county commissioner, with the counties around the state, and I'm trying to remember who else was on the work group, just the whole collection of folks that are concerned with this issue to come up with, I think, a really good statute with the -A4s. That that just as staff mentioned, give us a classification of dangerous dogs and liability for the owner.
Any questions of the good senator?
I just have a couple of comments, Mr. Chair, because I sat on Ag and Natural Resources, and we heard this twice, and there were several work groups, and the work group was almost as bad as the one on 408, Representative McPherson, almost as bad. And the dash force, or what came out of that work group, you know, and people, you know, Jack Monroe, John Powell, as their counties were there, cities were there, and including, you know, at least one of the senators who voted against, one of the few senators who voted against that came to the table and came with suggestions and changes, and all that was rolled into the A4. And, you know, my recollection, unfortunately, and my apology, Mr. Chair, and Patrick tells me I'm wrong, was I thought we actually put the A4s into it and then sent it to this committee on our very last day before we walked out the door. But all seven members of the Ag Committee on our side supported the bills in the A4, and this is, in fact, the seventh hearing and work session on this bill. I mean, this one's about as watery as you get. You can't get much more compromise here, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Deckard. And yes, isn't it delightful to be here on a beautiful Saturday afternoon? I just want to make sure I had some constituents come to me pre-session in regard to a dog bill, and it was the categorization of the dog and for insurance purposes. And I just want to make sure, and for the record, that this bill pertains only to dogs that are deemed dangerous by any physical act that they have or dangerous act that they've already committed. So that puts them in the category of dangerous dog, not just simply by because of a certain breed.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, that is the big improvement that happened to the bill. And I think one of the hearings that the Vice Chair mentioned is that was, I think, the biggest improvement was really using the behavior of the dog rather than the breed of the dog. And it really came from a lot of folks from your county, Clackamas County, who said, you have a good idea here. Here's a way to improve it. By use the characteristics, not the breed, but the characteristics of the dog's behavior to determine if it's a threat to animals or to people. And so, yes, that was changed in the bill before it moved over to the House Agriculture Committee.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Senator, I had a chance to read all the amendments, but we had another piece or another bill that was going through that won't make it now. It talks about protecting a dog, another dog, from being harassed by a dog, and this covers that in a dog going after other animals.
What got included, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Barker, was at least the classification, because it was the woman, I think she may be from Representative Flores' district, whose horse was killed, and I don't know if that was, I know it was in Clackamas County, whose horse was killed by a dog, and that behavior, that menacing behavior would be included as you can see in the bill.
Well, the one I'm thinking of is a blind woman whose service dog was being harassed by other dogs to a point where it became a worthless, I mean, a very expensive trained animal was unable to perform its duties. And so if a dog is not just harassing but seriously menacing, that would cover that as well, I would assume.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're looking expectantly, Mr. Chair. I hate to disappoint. I wanted to get something on what I think is on the record here. It looks to me as though, under the language of the A4, as though a dog does not have to actually have inflicted an injury in the past in order to be considered a dangerous dog. That if they engage in menacing behavior, I'm not sure I'm reading this all correctly, but lunging, growling, snarling, or other behavior by a dog that would reasonably cause a reasonable person to fear for the person's safety, that would be sufficient to be deemed a dangerous dog without having to actually have inflicted injury. This is just on a quick scan, and I've spent like just a couple of minutes here. Senator Decker, do you can you confirm that or steer me right on the text?
I will confirm what you just said. That is correct.
Okay. And if I could just follow up with a comment, Mr. Chair, I think that's an important aspect of the bill, and I'm pleased to see that. That you know, there's an old saying that every dog gets one bite, And I think in the case of some animals, that's too late. I think that we need to be able to identify behavior that's just not acceptable in the kind of settings in which we live near one another these days. Short of having somebody actually, an animal have inflicted an injury before we can identify them as dangerous.
Okay. Anything further?
Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendments into Senate Bill 844A.
Representative Roquist has moved the A4 amendments into Senate Bill 844A. Any objections? Amendments are in.
Chair, I'd like to move SB 844A as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 844A as amended to the floor with a due pass. Objections, comments?
No comments.
Okay, call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 844A as amended moves the floor with a due pass. And Representative Boquist, would you carry?
Delighted. Right, Senator?
Close the work session on Senate Bill 844A, and we'll be adjourned until 1 p.m. tomorrow.
Okay.